Hurra, hurra! Ein Design-Podcast der Burg. Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Hurra, hurra podcast. My dear listeners, you might have already noticed this is in English language, or what I assume could be an English language, because I'm not mother tongue English, I'm a German guy. Normalerweise spreche ich Deutsch, but in this podcast I switched to English because my guest is Ren Lauren Britton. Ren was a guest professor at the Burg Giebichenstein Kunsthochschule in Halle in winter 25-26. I wanted to say last semester, but who knows when when you hear that. So let's say currently. And to make this short and to listen to some more brief and elaborate English, I let you, Ren, do the talking. Ren, can you introduce yourself for a second? Because I have a very nice text from you on from your website that says you're a transdisciplinary artist designer who reverberates with transfeminism, technosciences, radical pedagogy, and disability justice. So that sounds quite buzzwordy, but who's the person behind it?
Thank you. Yeah, so I will start with a visual self description, as normal in disability community. So visual self description is a kind of practice or technology that's coming from blind and low vision community. Mm-hmm. And this is something that when sighted people enter into a space, we pick up on a lot of passive information regarding who's in the room, what they look like, mm-hmm. what kinds of relationship to queerness or to disability or to racialization we might have. So this is something I practice with. So I appear today as a white transmasculine person. I have a mustache that's new, brown curly hair. I'm looking at Christian in a recording. I think it's called Zencast. And so we're here online. I'm wearing headphones and a black shirt. Yeah, and indeed, maybe it's a bit buzzwordy, but I also try to put into my bio terms that relate to the kinds of political commitments and mm-hmm. value-based commitments that I have in my practice. So when I say I work with disability justice, that means that I am centering non-normative bodies and minds. And because that is a framework that's new to a lot of people, I also say that I work with transfeminism. Although if you're in the world of disability justice, you know that transfeminist ethics and values are central. So there's kind of some languaging that I use in there to pluralize my commitments and speak to the different values that I have in my practice. I work with a kind of critical relationship to technology that is looking at transfeminist technoscience, thinking about who are the agents of possibility within the techno-social worlds that we're in? What kind of socio-technical systems are we shaped by and that shape us? And a lot of my work and research deals with that, looking at it through infrastructures, different histories that I relate to in my practice. I'm really interested in different forms, like forms of being together, forms of other, like of producing otherwise possibilities. And I have this kind of hyphenated artist designer. I think I work both in design and arts practice. I come from a background in fine arts and have worked in more design-oriented fields for some years now because I'm interested in the affordances of putting a wedge into a system that doesn't suit us that I find design practice to enable. Mm-hmm. So,
thank you. I start in the beginning. You said, can you just repeat, how did you call the practice that you describe yourself?
Mm-hmm. It's called a visual self-description.
A visual self-description. Mm-hmm. That's great, because I think also because we have a very non-visual format here. I try that too. I might try that too.
Please.
But before I try it, I just say why I'm a bit uncomfortable with it, because as this is a non-visual format, I also like the fact that few people know me, and if they just start Googling, they will find a photo of myself. But this is not from importance, you know, that we do not have that sight factor here. So anyway, I tried it anyway. So I sit in a studio. I have a laptop in front of me. There's this Zencaster visual interface. I see Ren. Now we can have quite an interesting feedback inception with his new mustache written behind. There is an interesting array of, I guess, living plants. And in my environment, there is some sort of chaos. So if something is quite rustling, then it's all the papers that lie on my desk, because there's the structure of the podcast that we will have, and the CV of Ren, and my mobile phone that is on flight mode. And yeah, now it gets a bit difficult. I think I'm a white cis man with glasses and a beard. Is that correct?
I think it's also something that practices of visual self-description are also things to experiment with, right? So how we appear to the world are also what kinds of transparencies or opacities about ourselves we wish to make known. Mm-hmm. It's also a series of choices. So for myself, I choose to openly name my transness or my neurodivergence, for example, when speaking about myself in terms of visual self-description, to identify with the communities that I center in my work and practice, and also so that folks from disability community recognize me as speaking in aligned with our community, mm-hmm. or in alignment with our community, I would say. But there's quite some references or projects around this, like Alt Text is Poetry, for example, from Finnegan Shannon and Kokania Boquette. This is a reference that also speaks to, this is more on alt text or image description, mm-hmm. but practices of what it is, when you look at something, what do you see? And this is a very political question. It's a question of what has formed you, what kinds of experiences of the world are kind of pulled forth in that. I think there's not a right way of doing it. Like I'm mm-hmm. saying this in air quotes, but there's a practice of thinking about what is it that we see when we look, and also what kinds of ways can we decenter the visual from a disability justice perspective. It's true. It's like the podcast is not a visual form, but there are a lot of kind of aesthetic hierarchies and aesthetic practices that are still in operation in all sorts of forms that I guess that my practice really tries to tangle with. So that's why I bring it.
In your self-description, or how you introduce yourself, you said that your work is value-based. Can you describe these values a bit, or what do you mean with that? Because it sounds a bit, isn't every creative work in a way value based, or where does it differ from the, let's say, overall generic value based work that we have?
I guess it's for me, I think about it in terms of what are the people, who are the people that I'm working for, mm-hmm. who are my community members that I'm researching to uplift and be in dialogue with, what kinds of stories am I telling that produce an alternative to the kind of white Western cisgender non-disabled norm. And so for me, I guess I think of like the values of my practice as a kind of guiding set of orientations towards how I make decisions mm-hmm. and what it is that I do. So because I work from a disability justice informed perspective, that means that I'm interested in things around like multimodal access. So when I'm making an exhibition or making a course, for example, we know each other from the context of work. For me, there's very much like I make decisions from the basis of what kinds of access can be made in this moment, what kinds of ways of pluralizing modes of knowing are possible, what kinds of solidarities can be articulated along the lines of access-based and decolonial frames. So I guess, indeed, I'm sure a lot of people work with a value-based practice. I'm not alone in this at all. And I find that exciting because I think that the values that we have shape the world that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And the world that I want to be in, I think, is an accessible and pleasurable one. But I guess I use it as a kind of decision-making tool, perhaps, mm-hmm. or practice in my work around what am I interested in? And also, what is the kind of political affect that the work that it is that I'm making produces? I'm really interested in the, maybe this is not like a value, but I'm interested in connection. So I'm interested in modes of pluralizing connection from a transfeminist and disability justice perspective. So what does that mean? It pluralizes a lot of methods actually about how that can go. And that's what, I'll put a pin in it. I think I'm losing the point a little bit, but that's how I think of that.
I think it's important because you really rushed in through your introduction and I just was making notes, to not lose track. And you said it there, you repeated it now, and you have it also in your CV. And I just want also for all the listeners who are not familiar with the term, and honestly, I'm belonging to that group. How do you define transfeminism again? What is that part? Because it's, I tried to understand it from a transhuman perspective because it's a bigger discourse that I know, but keep going. Take me in, please.
Yeah, okay, happily. Transfeminism is definitely not transhumanism.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very different discourse, and I would draw very few through lines between them. Some people that I'm currently following regarding transfeminist thinking are Maike van der Drijf, who wrote this book on transfeminist ethics. And I think it's also Maike van der Drijf and Nat Raha. It's a dual authored book that speaks about transfeminist ethics for the world that we need.
Mm-hmm.
Or also Emma Heaney has edited this collection that's called Feminism Against Cisness. Just as a kind of few like kind of points out there. Also, my good friend and colleague, Jara Rocha, also working in the Spanish-speaking context in Barcelona, they also work on transfeminism. And the way that I think about transfeminism and I work with it it's a feminism that is embracing all plural genders.
Okay.
So we understand that gendered experience is a plural experience. And with the way that Hara speaks about it, a colleague that I love and work with regularly, they think about transfeminist in terms of this kind of gender star. So often when writing transfeminism, it's the word trans and then an asterisk and then the word feminism. And they think of this asterisk as a kind of moment of pluralizing feminist struggle and connecting it to other sorts of aligned struggles. What they mean by that is a kind of anti-colonial ethic, an anti-imperial ethic. A set of anti-capitalist politics, and these are the ways in which how can we think feminism, which demands and requires that a world is practiced and can be where anyone is not marginalized on the basis of their gender expression, and no matter what that gender expression is, how can it center those that are impacted by patriarchal violences often, which are more often than not trans and intersex people, and how can those interwoven struggles be connected to other intersectional struggles like anti-colonial, anti-imperial struggle. So I would say that transfeminism for me is really an opening mechanism to connect to other sorts of anti-colonial movements. And it's really thinking about centering trans folks and inter folks who are heavily impacted by patriarchal violence.
So this is like a, is it like a sub-discipline to intersectional feminism?
It's in line with intersectional feminism.
Okay, so with a more focus on the trans and inter folks.
Yeah, it's a bit more of a focus on trans and inter experience. Okay. Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say that. I think that intersectional feminism, what do we think about intersectional feminism, right? So intersection, like Kimberly Crenshaw, thinking about the Combahee River Collective, like if we're looking at the history of intersectional feminist practice, right? We're really thinking about this kind of famous metaphor of the intersection, right? So the crossroads where two different lived experiences meet. Mm-hmm. No, this is also something that is in alignment with transfeminist values, right? So thinking about how we are oppressed on the basis of cisgenderism, so the stability of a certain kind of cisgender expression or experience, and we are also oppressed by the patriarchy, which assumes white cisgender maleness is the thing that we should all be benevolent towards, right? So I would say that intersectional feminism is in constant solidarity with transfeminism. I wouldn't make those distinctions. I also think another reference for the listeners would be C. Riley Snorton, who's a Black transfeminist thinker who's thinking a lot about kind of the racialization, like the experiences of how racialization also plays into how people are allowed to express their gender. So mm-hmm. I think that thinking through Black and POC and BIPOC genders is also transfeminist in its heart. So I think that this this work of naming different kinds of feminisms is important because it also helps us to pay attention to the political solidarities that we're making. But I would rather construct feminism as a desirous project where a lot of different struggles can be held within feminist struggle. And intersectional feminism is also transfeminism, is also anti-colonial feminism, is also the kind of feminisms I'm interested in, the feminist project that I'm interested in kind of attracts shared struggle to it, not makes these cuts and says it's not that.
Thanks. Okay, yeah. Just to make it, this was, I think this is good because it's a topic that is important to talk about, but I also feel a bit uncomfortable because I'm not really firm with all the terms and what is what. So that's why I had to ask. And I do it in a sort of a service for the listeners to get more plastic image of what is the discourse about. And you really did it well because I like the fact that I tried to go back to the beginning because I want to explain what I saw, because you did the gesture of where you crossed your arms on the wrists and displayed a intersection. And I think that helped a lot to understand what where the trends and the intersections meet. So I make a note, a cross-check short introduction about yourself by 18 minutes. That was a very long, short introduction, but it was a very good one. But what did you do at Bork? So you've been guest professor there and in the visual communication department and in the Studiengruppe, which is the part which is more about information design. What did you do with the students there?
So the semester project that I offered when I was the guest professor at the Studiengruppe was called On Collective Access. And maybe I just read, so at the beginning of it, I started with this quote from Imani Babarin, who's a disability justice activist, and they say, accessibility is imagination in practice. So I really liked that because when we're thinking through access or thinking through modes of access, what kinds of imaginations are at the center of the kind of work that we understand ourselves to be doing as designers. This was really like a central question of the class or of the semester project. So throughout the semester, we had a series of indeed intersectional and transfeminist inputs from colleagues, which guests of ours were Lijen Brown, Femke Snelting, Pernilla Philip, and Simo Tier. And in each of these, we had two mini symposias that were organized by the colleagues that were in the course. And we were really looking at questions of collective authorship. So how do we think through what collective authorship means? What kinds of relationship to making and owning something do we wish to have as designers when we make something? Do we say, here's copyright, Renlore in Britain, I put my stamp on it and then you buy it from me? Or do we think about the network of relations that produce the possibility to make something? And how is, and maybe by the way that I'm speaking about it, I'm interested in the latter. So I'm interested in this kind of fecund network of relations that allow us to be in a different world. In the class, we also thought a lot about like prefigurative politics. So thinking about how we understand that a different world is possible because we can be in it partially, although that is not the world that we live in all the time. So what are the ways in which we can kind of be in a different set of relationships that would actually be sustainable, giving, nurturing, and supporting to our values and to our community rather than to burn us out, which is often the kind of capitalist logic that a lot of design practice operates within. So this was, one part of it was really through thinking through collective authorship. And another part was really drawing that in alignment with disability justice informed practice. So as we started, there was this introduction of myself with a visual description, right? So thinking through how visuality meets things. That's a technology or a tool or a practice that's coming from disability justice community. And often disability justice informed practices are about pulling many people together and shifting a cultural norm so that more people can be there. And I find there's a lot of similarities with this kind of, we want everyone to be here attitude that comes from disability justice practice, and we want to challenge this notion of mastery or this notion of singular authorship. So the course really tried to put together these two conversations. So practices coming from, access writers, coming from image descriptions, coming from visual descriptions, working with different roles, like setting up interdependent structures in the class where people could really take on a position at and practice learning something together. There's a lot of like structuring that was like disability justice informed structuring, and then a lot of research that had to do with unmaking singular authorship. And I was like, we're just going to put these two things together and we'll see what comes out. And so it was a really beautiful time. I miss the colleagues already that were there. I'm actually looking at another visual thing that our podcast listeners won't be able to see. This is a class. This is the candle that my colleagues in the class made for me. It says, "Our hearts burn for you," which is very sweet. And we had a class candle. So every time we were in class, we had a candle that was on, burning. And at the end of class, we would blow it out. So we were really experimenting with different more modes of being together. Maybe a candle would allow us to kind of register how much time had passed, and maybe doing a check-in where we shared our names, pronouns, and access needs at the beginning of every class would also shift how people felt like they could be there. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of rehearsing different ways of being together through different structures.
Also, again, a packed long sentence. Thanks a lot. I want to clear things up. Did you say access writers?
Writers. Yeah.
What is that?
An access rider is something coming
like
from
a technical rider.
Like a technical rider, exactly. Mm-hmm. It comes from that as, or it has a relationship to a technical rider. So indeed, if you're a famous musician and you go to a club, you send ahead of time your technical rider. And it's like, I need this amp, I need that chord, my guitar looks like this, I need that microphone to sound the best. This is my needs. These are my needs. An access rider is something that negotiates the reality that we live in an ableist world. So in an ableist world, disabled and neurodivergent and trans people are never expected or planned for in advance. So because that is the case, access riders are something that attempt to reduce the amount of labor that us as disabled and trans people have to do when we meet any infrastructures that are not set up for us. So it's a document, oftentimes a PDF, mm-hmm. that has information that you willfully send ahead to a cultural institution or a class that you're taking, some sort of context that you will be in that likely has not planned for you. And it negotiates this reality by letting people know what you would need to be actually able to be there. Mm-hmm. And it enables disabled, neurodivergent, trans people to be able to be in spaces, hopefully with their needs being respected, so that we can actually work and not be burnt out. So it's a kind of transitional document or a kind of tool that negotiates the needs for safety and the needs for access and the needs for being somewhere and being well with the reality of the ableist world that we live in. We worked in the class, people were invited to make their own access rider, mm-hmm. and also reflect on what's enabling for them in collaborations or in learning.
Very good. And that comes to the second questions I had, because in the introduction round that you described in the class, mm-hmm. where everybody comes up with their pronouns and their access needs. So this is basically mm-hmm. the access rider everyone brings in for the day. So today I'm, so there's like the structural situation everybody is in because of an ADHD whatever s and is not capable to follow longer conversations or has to walk around to concentrate and to focus, so that is being told, and that plus today I'm also I have a hammering headache. And please don't take me wrong if I close my eyes, because I want to follow you and your thoughts, but I can't if my eyes are open. So is mm-hmm. it something like that?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Access needs can definitely be anything from like, I have a hammering headache just like that. Mm. Or if you have like a bad trauma day, for example, and you're particularly triggered. And so mm-hmm. you're trying to be there, but you're not sure if you can. If you have other care responsibilities and you need to go early to care for someone else, it's a way of like letting people know what would allow your body mind to mm-hmm. be there fully, and also what possibilities there are not for that. And I think that when you share your access needs regularly in any sort of meeting or class space, it also shifts the kind of social permissions that people have to show up more fully as themselves, mm-hmm. because it removes a kind of judgment. It like acknowledges the fact that we all have bodies and minds that are, you know, in flux all the time, and makes space for us to talk about that and care for it.
Yeah. How do you, or how did you deal with that constant flux? Because from a very, it's not even old school, I somehow follow that idea as well. The idea of, okay, we have Joe Fix, everybody has to be there on point, and we have to talk through things, and we have a plan for the whole semester that is set up with not everybody in, because we do not know the people in front, but we have to make the plan for the whole term. And also we have an articulated, or maybe it's just informal or something, that we have in, as teachers or educators or course guides or how we ever see ourselves, have in mind what should be the outcome of the term. Mm. If we have to deal with the flux all the time, people pop out, pop in because of their individual needs, how do you run the course? It sounds like super, super complicated to, and I don't know if the word is right, affording, so that you have to be really spontaneous and it's not spontaneous. I don't know if the word spontaneous is right, but you have to react to the room all the time and reshift the day target or the overall aim that you go for. Is that like that? I mean, it sounds complicated to me.
I can appreciate that. I think that it's always complicated to negotiate different access needs. Mm-hmm. But I also think that in most pedagogical spaces, mm-hmm. many disabled, neurodivergent, and trans people are regularly deprioritized within that space. So when, as someone who shares those lived experiences, my experience of education when I was studying was often hostile. And I often had a lot of embodied impacts from trying to maintain a certain idea of status quo. Mm-hmm. So I think that when you fall out of who is perceived to be the right person studying, for me, this has really shaped my pedagogy, because for me, I have really considered what is enabling for me to be able to study as someone with my particular body mind. And how can that shift the values and the priorities of who's centered in the classroom space that I hold? So I think that there's like some frames of reference that are coming from disability justice that I think with. So for example, trusting, like working with process over outcomes. So mm-hmm. indeed, when you're in a classroom, there is the reality that we're supposed to do something here. We're supposed to finish something at the end. We're supposed to learn something and kind of accomplish a certain thing. But with a disability justice informed pedagogical model, actually what's more important is the built relationships that we have with each other in the classroom and mm-hmm. the ways in which we're actually able to internalize and learn what it is that we're learning and take it into our experiences and do something with it. So it's not a testing model where I need to test you at the end to understand if you got A, B, and C point, but it's more like, how can the environment of this class shift the kinds of perspectives that you have towards what kinds of bodies and minds are welcome in your practice, including your own. So for me, this is very process oriented as a method, as a pedagogical strategy. And another thing that comes to mind when you ask the question is about, there's this line that I really love from, I think it's from Adrienne Marie Brown, that is, it says, when you trust the people become trustworthy. So for myself as a pedagogue, mm-hmm. as a teacher, I really have thought a lot about how education systems or educational environments are often places of non-trust. So as a teacher, I am presumed to know more than the students. And there is a kind of top-down approach as though my experience of knowledge should be the one that pervades over the students in the classroom. And I don't believe that. I believe mm-hmm. that I come with a certain sensibility and a set of priorities and interests and values, as everyone else in the class does too. And they have different lived experiences than me, and we can learn with each other. So I think that shifting a classroom space so that we can all be in trust with each other and experiment together and learn together through a different set of relationships that is possible in the container of the classroom is actually what I'm interested in. And the third thing that comes to mind regarding your question is also just like reality. So conflicting access needs. So what you're describing, an experience of, let's say for myself, in order to focus well, I need a lot of quiet. And I know that quite some friends of mine need a lot of fresh air to feel well. Right. And if we're in a busy city space, for example, and we keep the windows open, I can't follow the conversation and my friends are feeling suffocated. Mm-hmm. So we have conflicting access needs. And this is something that can happen in classroom spaces when people feel safe enough to be able to share what they would actually need to be there. We get into the sticky situation of, we maybe can't always be in the same place doing the same things at the same time. And I would say that that's a more humanizing reality of learning than is often the dehumanizing reality of learning, in which everyone has to learn in a particular way, and mm-hmm. that learning in a particular way regularly kicks out the same people.
Yeah.
So that's what I think. Yeah.
Very good. What do you describe? It's very interesting because that's what I maybe I learned it much more slower than you do. But that the fact that what we do as educators or course guides, or I don't want to say teacher, but this kind of these weird responsible, very well paid guys in front of class or in the room. Like, what is the job? And the job is to give people the power and the self-confidence to express their self creatively. I would also say to be able to work creatively. So I have, for me, for my let's say educative practice, my wish is to make people able to make money with their creative work, not to work in an Amazon package hub to afford a creative practice. I wish them to make money with their stuff, to be by this in a way self-confident to go for it like this, because it's a reality that we live in. But there is no, we do not reach that by punching them Adobe Illustrator in the face to test that in the end if every busy curve is right. But this self-confidence to stand up for my personal needs and how I want to work right is a much more longer lasting knowledge than that this old Illustrator version that is out of date when I'm out of my studies, and is by that much more humanist in a kind of old European way of thinking what humanism is. But this kind of humanist education that is human-centered and everybody can flourish flower up in a in an individual but caring way is something that is really cool. And my question would still be, how do you deal with consequences? I mean, that sounds all quite kumbaya a bit, in the way of, okay, everybody tells their needs and everybody is respectful and everything is working well, but in reality often these access needs are even more conflicting than the examples that you say. Did you, for example, change the room? Did you make like infrastructural changes so that we have that kind of quiet space there and we have that space there where, but just to stay in the example, where the windows are always open so that we do not have to change ourselves, but maybe we can change the space. So how did you deal with that? And how is there a kind of a best practice how to act with like troublemakers in that case, people that do not really fit in these caring way of being together?
I think so. Yes, in the classroom, in the On Collective Access course, we did indeed change the structures. Mm-hmm. So, some of the structures that we had every time that we would meet for class was that there was someone who would, there were two break people, so people that would remind us about our bodies to take breaks. Mm-hmm. There were two people to set up the hybrid infrastructure. So the class was hybrid by default, meaning that you could always join online. And sometimes mm-hmm. as a teacher, I also joined online. There were people that were taking collective notes. So if you were not able to join that day because of life, you could follow the notes asynchronously. Someone would turn on and blow out the candle. There were a few facilitation people. So people that needed, if we were doing a exercise or something that needed facilitation, people could take on those roles. And so I guess this question of dealing with consequences is interesting to me because I think that it also proposes quite some defaults of design practice that are already standard. And I think that really what the class that I held attempted to do was to unmake what kinds of standards we are working within to be able to live within a different world and really sense that, feel it, practice it, and see what it does in relationship to what's considered normative design practice. So the consequences of being in a world that are that is so attentive to embody-minded difference is that it's a sensitizing practice, right? This means that I hope that the people that were in my course or that have that have studied in it, the feedback that I received was that people really felt seen as a person, and then also can then go and see how they can transform that knowledge of what it is to witness their own experience and others' experiences and be able to design from a perspective that's about really caring for that rather than coming back to the only thing that's most important is the bottom line or the only thing that's most important is the outcome. I think it's really about like a cultural shift towards shifting towards ongoing relationality with people and making it possible that those of us that are often kicked out of creative and design careers can actually be in them because the terms of the career or the job itself shift. So the course tried to model a paradigm shift in terms of who can be a designer because those of us that are often rendered designers are going to highly elite schools. There's a lot of white people. There's a lot of non-disabled people. There's a lot of people that mean well, but that don't have any tools to actually shift practices so that we can actually be in complex collectivity in a way that would allow for difference to actually be. So the class and the course that I taught really is trying to, the consequences that it's relating to are the fact that the design world that I operate in or that many of us operate in repeats a lot of ableist, colonial, white supremacist norms as default. Those are the consequences that we are currently living in. And so the production of an otherwise world is a lot of work. It's a lot of like holding, actually open a space, and also setting up other structures that would allow for a different kind of generative thinking and feeling and making and set of relationships to emerge. So that's maybe how I would respond.
Yeah, it's the paradigm shift. It's rendering a different world. It's trying out how a design practice can, at air quote, work in a way. Maybe the word consequences is a bit difficult, but I think about a code of conduct. It's something that is in the nonprofit organization I work parallel to my teaching practice. We often work with younger audiences, so with like students, pupils, however you call them. They are in the age of, let's say, 12 years to 16 years. And in the spaces we open up, we have that code of conduct that is somehow it's not that detailed, and it does not have, maybe it has in the back this kind of access rider thing, but it's not upfront to that. But how do we want to act? So how do we respect each other's boundaries? How do we do not be homophobic even just because of fun? You know, that's kind of what like pre-adolescent kids often think is funny. And we do not call it rules. We call it code of conduct in a way. So, but still, there are these these guys who do not respect that. And I think about that, and it's often a direct approach. We talk to them, hey, what's up? Why do you do that? Mm-hmm. And blah blah blah. And they still keep troublemaking, for example. So then we have to exclude them because they break the whole system. So, but this is interesting because we try to be set up as, and that's a respectful and open space, but we still have to exclude people who disturb. And if we say disturb, we are in the same wording as in my school, because there was I the guy who was disturbed, because everybody was sitting quiet on their chairs and were listening and looking in the one direction. But there's also the guy who's disturbing. And I ask that as an open question, mm-hmm. and really interested, how to deal with that, and by not just copying methods and approaches that come from old teaching and learning sciences. Can you say pedagogy? Yeah, it's these two G's that totally. I don't get it.
Pedagogic. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good question and a difficult one of mm-hmm. how to deal with people that, or how to deal with, or what does it mean to try and be in the practice of a different worlding, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, people that are really attached to a certain kind of worlding because of, I don't know, all sorts of reasons, can be hard to let go of that and to embrace a different world, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, rehearsing a different set of relationships is something that you have to come into practice with, right? It's not something that you just turn on and it's there. It's something that is an ongoing practice because a white supremacist, capitalist, ableist, patriarchal, colonial, imperial world is basically breathing down our neck all the times, and increasingly so right now. And so we internalize these things. We internalize mm-hmm. these systems. And even if we say that we're like the most radical people studying art, they're still in us, you know? So to unlearn this and to become actively changing that is also internal work and collective work and pedagogical work and social work, right? So there's so many scales that we're speaking through here. And I have colleagues that I think with about this. One that comes to mind is Mayan Boga, who thinks about, I have this text open, this is Political Ontologies of Difference and their trilemic structure. I've been taking a lot of inspiration or solace in her work recently, because in this she talks about, I'm looking at this diagram here that I thought that I might talk about in this conversation, where she talks about inclusion, diversity, or anti-discrimination work. Mm-hmm. So this is a kind of umbrella. And you could see a code of conduct, for example, as being a tool of anti-discrimination work, right? It's a way, code of conducts, as I understand them, are a way of unseating the normative patterns in social space, which have to do with those that are closest to normative sites of power are easily in that space. Yeah. So then if you have a code of conduct, you're trying to make a different space possible where those of us that have different relationships to power structures can also be there, right? And how to hold that within this reality of the world. In her work, she has these three terms around empowerment, normalization, and deconstruction. This is interesting because in terms of empowerment, so we could talk about transness, for example. So I'm trans and I can talk about being in a trans-centric space, which is about empowering trans people. Mm-hmm. This is a different project fundamentally than normalizing transness. So normalizing transness is the work of making it so that everyone is like cool with transness. Everyone knows trans people, like we're all, this is like cool, right? It's like, it's a normalizing factor where it's not about empowering a certain community. That's not the political project. The political project is normalizing it. So transness is something that people don't become upset about anymore. Mm-hmm. This is also a different project, again, from deconstruction. So deconstruction would be undoing the sex gender construction of the world, thinking about how there's 1,000 different sexes, if you wanted to follow Deleuze or something, and think about how we're like deconstructing the terms of how sex and gender are constructed, right? And so these are different, as she talks about it, this trilemma of theories of inclusion. So I think that this work of collect codes of conduct, what are they trying to do? I would guess that they're actually trying to normalize certain things and deconstruct as well, right? They're not usually about empowering only one group. I wonder if you would disagree with me. I think that she points out in her thing that it's really hard to do all three at the same time, and it's mostly that you need to choose one or two to work on. Yeah. So I think that this kind of balancing and negotiating of affordances and possibilities in different spaces is the reality because of the world that we live in, which is structured through ableist white supremacy. So because that is the case, then what kinds of movements are possible is an ongoing negotiation, I would say.
Yes. And I still, it sounds, you have to share, it would be great if you can share this diagram so we can put it in the show notes, and maybe you can also put it in Instagram to for people to visualize what we've been talking about, or what you've been talking about. But I have this point that there is a group, everybody's cool, and there's this one trouble. I don't know if trouble, don't take me wrong if I say troublemaking, but there's this kind of, maybe it's an aggression, maybe it's just an, I don't care about the reasons anyway, because it's, you feel that there is disturbance, and everybody wants to be cool, but this one person really just breaks every kind of framework that has been set up even together, and there is no capacity to because there are external factors like time frames, space frames, I don't know what other frames there are possible, but to get, and this person really don't wants to fit in, but there is also how do I mean we do not want to exclude, you know, this is the point. We do not want to exclude, but if people do not have the, let's say the toolbox to be included for themselves, and we do not have the time to teach or to give them the time and space to learn the tools to be included, how to deal with these people, or how do you experience this, or don't you have this experience because all the settings that you work in do not have that kind of basic conflicts because everybody is cool from the beginning? I don't know, don't get me wrong, I'm really interested in that. I do not want to pick you in a certain way, that, but I don't want to, I want to really understand how to act in these cases, to be fair and to be inclusive and to respect all these needs. But sometimes as a teacher or as an educator, you come to this kind of frontier boundary that where I start to get to the point I don't know how to do that.
Well, it sounds like it's a research question for you in terms of, you know, in terms of how to continue to work on this. I can see that the things that I'm saying spark this in you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, positively. You know, it starts a chain of thoughts, or maybe it's not a chain. That sounds, it's too linear. It's more like a grid of question marks, and that confuses me a bit. Maybe it also triggers me a bit, because it gets in this dilemma of making everything best for everybody, but then it doesn't work out. because you cannot make everybody happy in the classroom.
Maybe to come back to the beginning of the podcast a little bit, that's also this question of like value-based practices, right? So I'm not trying to make everyone happy, actually. I'm trying to work against ableist white supremacy, which actually pisses off a lot of people.
Okay.
Right? So, I mean, if you're working against a dominant power structure like ableism and like white supremacy, I am going counter to what is considered to be normal within pedagogical environments, the kind of ways of structuring space that people just do because that is what they've always done. That is what I am actively unmaking. So indeed, it can really piss off a lot of people. And I'm interested in, as a person holding space in workshops and classes, when I was a professor at Borg, in holding the difficulty that comes with participating in a different kind of world building. So I would also say that I hear you regarding time and resources. I also think that those are choices as well. So I think at every moment there's not enough time. It happened regularly in the class that I taught on collective access. I remember there was this one moment where we were having these two mini symposiums, and one of the groups was super overwhelmed because they were like, oh, this thing is coming up so soon, and we have to do this, and we have to do this, and we have to do this, and we have to do this. And I remember being like, hey, whoa, slow down. Who said you had to do all this? I didn't say that. You said that. Why are we doing this? You know, and it like, and it really, to shift the paradigm to doing something and saying, we can do this well, and we will do this because we know that that's what's interesting for us, and this is what we have the capacity for. And so then we're going to care for this and make it away from, we have to do this 70,000 item list because that's what should be done. This kind of should mentality is also like capitalist logic that gets into our bodies, where we're supposed to overperform and exhaust ourselves all the time. But actually, if the only thing that we can do is five things well, and then we say, hey, we couldn't do those other 70,000 things, but we did these five things well, and we communicate it. And then you have an internal structure that can hold, and the people that made those five things are like, wow, we really like each other. We can keep working. I didn't get so exhausted that I got sick, you know, like that's a different paradigm. And so then I think, and indeed in one of the mini symposias, there was like a list of things that didn't happen. And they were just like, well, we couldn't do those things because we didn't have the time for it. And I think that's great, you know, because it's a choice around capacity and time and resources. And this is what I mean by saying that like prioritizing relationships over outcomes is really central to the kind of practice that I want to have in my own life and also want to teach. So.
Yeah, that's great. And yeah, maybe I'm myself. I'm so, maybe not so, but partly stuck in this kind of overperformance, or how you described it, in this kind of should, and yeah, we can do this, and we can do this, and we just have to just get our stuff together, and we can also do this and this. You know? I don't know when this, how to it, and I think it's good that in the way you set up your course, you maybe it's just breaking this chain of overperformance and try to see what are the needs, the access needs, or the needs everybody, or the, and if you look at the needs, you maybe can also maybe more responsibly say what are your resources that you can offer into the game. And I think that's a good end for the podcast, because now I have to look at a wall and think for a while. Because it goes deep.
It's about unmaking the way that we work in a way to actually shift it so that the terms can be available for non-normative bodies and minds, and stepping off of the capitalist drive to overperform as the only way to survive. And that's very tied into notions of singular authorship and building yourself as someone who is the master of something. It's really about taking all that off and thinking, what are we making in terms of practice here? What are our relationships? What kinds of what kinds of possibilities do we want to have for ourselves and what we're making? It's a different paradigm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a therapy session, you know, like it started with, oh yeah, I have nothing to say. Everything is fine. Yeah. 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 And now it's like, ah, fuck, I have this kind of knot in the head. And
We'll stay in touch. You can email me.
Cool. Aaron, that was a very great conversation. I learned a lot. I think these show notes will be we call it show notopedia, with all the references and interesting persons you brought in. Thanks a lot. I will hit the red button. We stay here in our comfortable online situation. But I say goodbye to all the listeners and thank you, Ren.
Thank you so much.
Hurra, hurra, ein Design-Podcast der Burg.